back to New Books in Native American Studies. I'm Andrew Epstein, and thanks for listening to this podcast for the New Books Network. Each month, we pick a newly published work in Native American and Indigenous Studies and spend the hour speaking with the author. Today, I'll be joined by Dr. Jody Bird, Assistant Professor of American Indian Studies and English at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign and a citizen of the Chickasaw Nation of Oklahoma. We'll be discussing her new book, The Transit of Empire, Indigenous Critiques of Colonialism, just released from the University of Minnesota Press. This is a work of tremendous intellectual breadth and a poignant intervention on critical theory, which often relegates indigenous criticisms to marginal places in the canon. If Phil DeLoria's seminal work, Playing Indian, explored the conscious appropriation of symbolic Indianness and the perpetual U.S. quest for legitimacy, Jody Bird finds numerous moments where Indianness is actively disavowed, despite its constitutive and originary role in so much of settler society. This inquiry takes Bird from Shakespeare's Tempest to the Jonestown Massacre, from the origins of blues music to the transit of planets across the night sky. Traversing this wide terrain is a fundamental project, the insistence that colonization matters, that memory matters, that indigeneity matters. This intervention engages both the titans of critical theory and the discourse of mainstream politics, offering us new conceptual tools for decolonization. I hope you enjoy our discussion. Hello, Dr. Bird.
Hello.
Welcome to New Books in Native American Studies. Today we're discussing your new book, The Transit of Empire, Indigenous Critiques of Colonialism. It's just released from the University of Minnesota Press and published in conjunction with the First Peoples New Directions in Indigenous Studies Consortium. The intellectual breadth of this work you've produced is staggering, and I'm excited to dive in. But before we do so, I'm just hoping you can tell our listeners a little bit about yourself.
I'm at the University of Illinois, where I'm an assistant professor of American Indian Studies and English. I'm a citizen of the Chickasaw Nation of Oklahoma. I grew up actually, though, in Valentine, Nebraska, which made me a sort of diasporic Chickasaw living in a border town next to Rosebud Reservation, which is, it was really informative with how I kind of came into understanding the world just from having seen the structures of colonialism as it played out in Valentine and helped form who I was as a person all along.
Sure. I'm hoping you can talk a little bit about how you came to write this book specifically. You know, the theoretical or intellectual traditions you're coming out of or are in conversation with here, and what sort of interventions on them you wanted to bring to bear in this work.
Yeah, the book started a long time ago, and it started with sort of being a grad student. Right? We all go through grad school. I was at the University of Iowa, having finished a BA at the University of Nebraska. So I was sort of a Midwesterner all through this in a way. And I got to Iowa, realized just how unique I was as a Chickasaw who grew up in Valentine, and was sort of frustrated that the theory I was reading, the courses I was taking weren't really reflecting the world that I had seen up to that point in my life. And so I wanted to try to find ways to bring indigenous peoples into a conversation about colonialism as I was sort of devouring post-colonial theory primarily as a way to develop a career in the academy.
You write that in the prevailing understandings of race and racialization within not just post-colonial studies, but area studies and queer studies, you write that they depend on an historical aphasia of the conquest of indigenous peoples. I'm hoping you can elaborate a bit more on that and talk a bit more about what you saw as the limitations of post-colonial theory specifically.
Well, post-colonial theory already contains a critique of its own project, I think, in the very nature of the way in which the post functions. A lot of people want to, and you know, it sort of is the sticking point in indigenous critical theory. We want to understand the post as temporal, as something that happens after colonialism ends. Though certainly there's debates within post-colonial theory about the post being the post-colonial starting at the exact moment colonialism starts. But there's all these other debates about the post as something much more towards how postmodernism functions. And the ways in which race and racialization start to inflect that, especially as these theories that were developed to address globalization, the larger history of particularly British imperialism, and then later U.S. imperialism abroad, it depended upon certain ideas about how the United States cohered itself as a nation state, about who was going to be included or excluded. And so when I talk about an aphasia of indigenous peoples, because there has been such a liberal investment in the idea that the United States as a nation state can remedy historical wrongs through more inclusion, from a Native perspective, that more inclusion is the culmination and fulfillment of the colonial project from the start.
You also mentioned at some point that in a lot of narratives and academic treatments of U.S. imperialism, the narrative tends to begin in 1898, let's say. And I remember dealing with this last semester with a geography book I was reading, a real tome called American Empire by Neil Smith. It, you know, it was a trenchant book. It was interesting, but it starts in 1898. I mean, this is the moment for him that imperialism or U.S. colonialism begins. You know, what's wrong with that narrative, and why is it so prevalent, do you think, in treatments of U.S. empire?
Well, it's kind of a consistent, I mean, there have been attempts to sort of push it back to the Mexican-American War. There's been attempts to push it back further. Of course, from Native Studies perspective, U.S. empire starts at the exact moment the United States is created. But 1898 marks a point where the United States starts to look across ocean water to build colonial acquisition. So what happens is the naturalization of the continent as belonging to the United States, where water marks something that people have to traverse through in order to get somewhere. And so it tends to invisibilize and mark the turning point as exceptional, though it's consistent with the United States policy all along.
And speaking of multi-continent transversals or transits, I want to hope that you can pull apart a few terms that you use throughout this work. First and foremost, the title of your work, Transit, and I'm hoping you can also talk about that in the context of a moment you refer to throughout the book in 1761, when European explorers scattered across the globe to observe and record this planetary transit of Venus across the face of the sun. Why is that moment important, and how do you extrapolate out of that moment into this broader idea of transit?
Yeah, well, I was really struck by particularly the 1769 transit. They come in pairs, the transits of Venus, separated by about 120 years, and then each of the transits themselves are 8 years apart within that 120-year cycle. They're considered rare. They happen only once in a person's lifetime. And ironically, the next transit that's coming up is in this June 6th, I think, actually, this 2012. So there's an anniversary of sorts. And from the sort of trajectories of it, it actually is mirroring almost exactly the 1769 transit that sent Cook into the Pacific. I heard about this story when I was on faculty at the University of Hawaii. We put together an indigenous governance class that we were teaching there with Diagi Alfred and Jeff Korntassel from the University of Victoria. And one of the things that we wanted to do is political science class, but we were wanting to make it interdisciplinary. So we brought in poets like Joy Harjo and Robert Sullivan to give readings. And Robert Sullivan is a Maori poet, and he's done an amazing collections of poetry, and in particular, he was commissioned to write basically the opera for Captain Cook in the Underworld. And so his work was really focused on the meaning of Venus within this larger trajectory of European colonialism. And it's a fascinating idea that, you know, European explorers are so obsessed with the stars that they're, you know, using these as the cover for the colonial project that they're undertaking. And, you know, as I started to go through some of the primary documents, looking at people like John Ledger, Captain Cook, I was finding Hawaiians, for instance, remarking back to Ledger that Europeans are so obsessed with the stars that they must have come from there and it's time for them to go back. So there's like a counter narrative that starts to happen in the discourse. And that idea of movement, of transversals, of transits themselves, became a way for me to think about what I was seeing, what I at least wanted to highlight in ways in which we think about U.S. history in regards to indigenous peoples, is that with all the emphasis on the frontier, we lose track of the ways in which indigenous peoples and Indians, the idea of the Indians, are the actual way in which the United States constructs itself in relation to empire. It's the justification, it's the rationale. We've often focused on the frontier after Frederick Jackson Turner, and Indians ultimately fall out of that space. And I wanted to bring Indians back as the justifying that narrative, and show how they become the site through which everything transits, crosses through, moves as empire spreads out from England to the east coast of the United States to Hawaii. It manifested in particularly interesting ways too, with, you know, from the start, where Benjamin Franklin not only is trying to learn about the Haudenosaunee Confederacy, but he's already envisioning New Zealand as a site for colonization, as something that belongs to and should be part of the United States. As the possible, ends of what U.S. empire imagines for itself at this 1769 moment.
Yeah. And reckoning with that certainly changes, again, how we draw the narrative of even overseas empire building, if it was already so much in the consciousness of settlers in the late 18th century. I also want to return in several places throughout the work to a concept in southeastern Indian cosmologies, the Haksuba, and I'm mm-hmm. I hope I pronounced that right. And you translate it as a cacophony. Can you speak a little bit about this idea of cacophony and Haksuba and why or how you utilize this term in the criticisms you're making in this work?
Well, the notion of the Haksuba comes from Leanne Howe's work, particularly a short story called The Chaos of Angels, where she sort of maps out at the beginning of the story the sort of the foundational notion of Southeastern cosmology. Leanne Howe's Choctaw, I'm Chickasaw, we're related communities. We have a deep and long history and many cultural similarities. And she uses the Haksuba in that story. She translates it as chaos, but another definition of it is a loud, deafening noise. And I wanted to have both the notion of the chaos, because one of the things within Southeastern cosmologies is we construct worlds that are existing in complementarily. We have the upper world and the lower world. This world, the one that we live in, the middle world, has to find a balance between what's happening between the upper and the lower worlds. When one thing comes out of balance, if there's too much of the influences of the upper world, then things tip, are too rigid. If things are too much in the lower world, more and more chaos gets introduced. And the goal for any right-minded Chickasaw or Choctaw is to find ways to balance out both of those. And so colonialism introduced this imbalance, for lack of a better word, into the ways in which Southeastern worlds functioned. And as a sort of unifying narrative, I was really fascinated with the idea of the kind of clamoring noises of everything needing to have a perspective, a voice, especially when we're looking at the United States, which ties itself to a certain kind of individualism and subjectivity that asserts injury in order to be redressed by the state, that the more and more that those individual injuries, those historical injuries, continue to articulate themselves, they had to do it at the cost of recognizing other people's, other perspectives, other individuals who themselves may be, in fact, injured as well. And how does one find balance in that is attuned to historical violences and to the broader network of power and oppression that was the question that I wanted to try to think through in my book. Whether I achieve that or not, I don't know. But the effort of trying to think through it was, for me, important for finding what could possibly be a Southeastern approach to understanding critical theory.
Mm. I mean, you ask a number of profound questions in this book, and I do think that you address them. I also hope that they also spur on further scholarly investment. Some of the questions that you pose, particularly in the beginning of chapter two, that lead into your discussion of the Tempest. If you don't mind, I'd love to read a couple of them because I think they're incredible. How did the impulse to constellate the Americas into European colonial alignment come to depend upon the lamentable but ungrievable Indian? What do you mean here by the ungrievable Indian?
Well, that was something I discussed in the first chapter to some extent, building off of the questions that Judith Butler asks in some of her more recent work about the war on terror after 9/11, and the notion of what a life has to do in order to be aggrievable within the larger narratives of nation states. And one of the things that has always struck me is that American Indians are lamentable, right? We owe the poor Indian. There's always a story of, Indian loss, Indian deprivation, but there is no real space in which to actually grieve the amounts of people who have been destroyed through the acts of, through the militarism, the violences of colonialism. Mm. And so because there's this lack of grievability at that level, there's actually, it's really hard to do anything to apprehend, to really take stock, and the apprehend goes in two directions, to take stock and understand and stop the violences that continue to destroy Native lives and other lives. I mean, it's not just American Indians caught in this, and I hope that's what my book was also trying to show, is that if we take Indians and put them into conversation with histories of slavery, and certainly Southeastern Indians were complicit with that, if we take it and bring it into conversation with things like Japanese American internment, all of these things sort of align and are working together, which is why, for me, that notion of cacophony was so important, is how do we hold on to multiple sites of historical violences and try to put them into balance in a way that addresses and engages what's happened primarily to Indigenous lands and Indigenous people.
I want to return to a few of the points you just mentioned a little later on. But I'm hoping you can talk a little bit about the Tempest. You talk about it specifically in the context of the Columbus Quincentennial in 1992. Mm-hmm. What is the significance of the Tempest in that moment, 500 years after the invasion of Columbus?
That's a big question.
Yeah.
It's surprisingly also really relevant right now. I've just been watching some of the news come through about books banned in Tucson.
Sure,
where the Tempest is one of the books that has been banned.
I noticed that myself. I heard an interview this morning. It was shocking. But I guess it kind of leads you into the multiple ways in which the Tempest can be read.
Right.
Well,
I mean, it was, in some ways people are trying to claim it too as the foundation of genre of fantasy and science fiction. The Tempest has always been this a rather interesting play. It's not anybody's favorite necessarily, but it's really rich in the ways and complicated in the ways in which Shakespeare was trying to grapple with the discovery of the New World at the moment he's writing it, and then placing it within this kind of allegorical geography that links it to both the Mediterranean, Africa, and the New World, and it sort of hovers between all three locations as it tries to grapple with the emerging discourses of colonialism that are about to be deployed. 1992, of course, with the quincentennial, because the Tempest was a story about the New World and discovery and slavery, it had a certain kind of ability to speak to the historical moment yet again. And one thing it's so hard to think about Shakespeare. The idea that he's being banned is stunning in Tucson. And I remember horrifying all my colleagues in grad school because I would always ask, why do we read Shakespeare? Why is he great literature?
Yeah, sure.
And yet, I can't. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, it's an interesting point to his testament that he would even be banned. It's, you know, all the other usual suspects were in that list. I mean, books that you can immediately see the political relevance in, Occupied America and the History of Chicanos, and then the Shakespeare's right. in there. It's very, very confusing. It makes me want to reread Shakespeare.
And it speaks to the amount of work, I think, that African writers, Caribbean writers, American Indian writers have done in order to sort of reimagine and reclaim Caliban particularly.
Mm. Yeah. Now, in your third chapter, you explore an event which I admittedly knew little about, the Jonestown Massacre in Guyana in 1978. In fact, you point out that, and there's this meme that exists, you know, drinking the Kool-Aid, and, you know, I've certainly heard it. It's almost ubiquitous in political culture.
Right.
I didn't know the origins of it myself. Probably even people who did know the origins weren't necessarily familiar with the degree to which Jim Jones, the leader of this Jonestown commune, called upon notions of Indianness in his religious community there, and as well as in reasons for the mass suicide that ultimately ends the community. I'm hoping you can talk a bit about how this fits into the larger project of your book, your criticism, particularly of some of the writing about Jonestown, and also how it helps us, as you write, examine the compelling and contradictory impulses of social justice within imperial contexts. I know, again, these are large questions that your whole book addresses, but if you can introduce the listeners to this issue in your book, that would be great.
Sure. The Jonestown part was probably one of the hardest things to write. I say that, and then I think, you know, the Friedman chapter was also really hard to write. But to delve into the deaths, the 900 deaths that occurred in suicide that occurred there, or the mass murder, I mean, depends on how you view Jim Jones, was really difficult because it's so easy to dismiss Jim Jones as a crazy man. And that's partly why it is that drinking the Kool-Aid can circulate the way it does, is because it becomes almost a punchline, as opposed to a real need on the part of the United States, Guyana, to grapple with the lives lost. And so, you know, back to that notion of grievability, what does it mean to grieve for these histories, and to grieve for these experiences, to see how what started as a really revolutionary social religion that Jones constructed ends up so horribly wrong. It's really difficult to sort of chart that, and then to see, you know, a lot of people have written about Jim Jones. I mean, I'm just thinking about the ways in which it circulates, even more most recently this summer, right? One of the major songs that came out by the Cult uses Jim Jones for the song Go Outside. They are using historical footage of the Jonestown Massacre and the People's Temple to create a song about that, just essentially resisting somebody who wants to stay inside where they'd rather go outside, as if the way in which to think about the cult itself is about mind control. And all these things sort of collapse in on themselves. For me, what was really stunning and, again, really difficult to look at was how in the exact moment of the night, the final white night that Jim Jones orchestrated, that there ends up being a movie discussion between Jim Jones and an African-American woman who is the only person to stand up to say suicide isn't the answer for us. And as I kept looking at that, and people have talked about that moment a lot in the scholarship, people have returned to it as a sign of, you know, this, you know, her attempt to really save everybody at Jonestown. And nobody had ever really talked about the fact that the movie that they're using as the site for their debate, the philosophical debate about life and death and the options facing them, is actually a movie about American Indians. And for me, that was, you know, exactly kind of the point of my book, which is that Indians become the site through which all of these different ideas of social justice, of violence manifest themselves. They emerge almost like a return of the repressed to evoke something from Freud. It's almost like, because it's so American, because the destruction of Native peoples, the colonization of Native lands is so ingrained into every structure that informs how the United States functions, it of course becomes the site through which people start to effectively emotionally invest themselves into.
I could probably keep going, I guess. It's up to you. This is probably also the moment to reiterate to our listeners that as in-depth as this conversation has been thus far, it's only the tip of the iceberg in terms of what you offer in this book. But we can move on here to talk a bit about another difficult subject, which is the subsequent chapter about Cherokee Freedmen, and what you call the racialization of citizenship. This section starts with a fascinating story. In 1901, the archaeologist Charles Peabody traveled from his perch at Harvard to burial mounds in Mississippi to disinter and disturb and rob the remains of most likely Chickasaws and Choctaws. To do the manual labor required, Peabody hires African-American workers, and he ends up writing about blues music, which he hears them singing in the labor. Tell us a bit more about this story and why you chose this as an introduction to your discussion of Cherokee Freedmen.
Yeah. And one of the things I used to joke about as I was working on the book is that my method was primarily to take an event or something that people thought they knew a lot about and then show how Indians were at the center of it. And I say that, and yet it is, surprisingly true. It's like, you wouldn't think, talking about the chapter before that Jim Jones and the suicides at Jonestown had anything to do with Indians, except, of course, Jim Jones claimed at certain points to be Choctaw and Cherokee. And then, of course, the what I found in the transcripts of the death tapes. And then in the case of Peabody and the mounds and the birth of the blues and what I say the white academic consideration, it was surprising to realize that, because everybody tells this story about Peabody. It's kind of like the starting point when people try to describe the origins of the blues. They turn to that because it was a documentation of the music by an anthropologist, even though, of course, blues had existed prior to Peabody hearing it. It often became a starting point for a lot of the books that I looked at. And, those same scholars would sort of gloss Native people's presence, or the fact that the South was a site that had peoples that were in it prior to anybody else being there, and I've always been influenced by musicians and thinkers like Joy Harjo, who is been spending a lot of her work bringing in to poetry the blues traditions of the South. She argues that the Muscogee Creek had to have had something to do with the creation of the blues, if only through the shared space of these, these histories overriding themselves into Southeastern Indian lands. Artists like Jura Faye doing significant work musically to make the argument to show sonically or to make perceivable blues progressions, the chordal nodal changes that are inherent within traditional Southeastern stomp dance music and what has become blues. And so for me, when I started with that story, the fact that it was the burial mounds, and again, this is the larger theme of grievability, the fact that those workers are having to disinter peoples that they may in fact be related to, and a story that Southeastern Indians may not always want to tell, that seems incredibly powerful. And then to link, because the next move I make in that is to show that within some of the stories about the origins of corn, the mounds are tied to a woeful sound, a woeful singing that came out of them. So I almost think at times when I was working on the book that the stories that Southeastern Indians have link the blues to the land itself, to how it comes out of and emerges from the very creation of some of the major food sources that Southeastern Indians survived on. Which isn't to say that Indians created the blues. I don't ever want to make that claim for us, but that it emerged out of, again, the confluence of colonization, slavery, the overriding of the colonialist culture into spaces that Southeastern Indians inhabited.
It's interesting when you mention that a lot of your work in this book is about moments where Indians are present or at the center of it, or at least some sort of Indianness is mobilized. In some ways, it seems very related, but also the inverse of Phil DeLoria's Playing Indian, where you have people consciously appropriating notions or symbols of Indianness, whereas here you have disavowals of it and deferments of it and intentional or unintentional forgetting of it. It's interesting contrast. In this chapter, you address the modifier internal that's added often to colonialism, the idea of internal colonialism. What's problematic or useful for you here in the concept of internal colonialism?
For me, what was problematic, I think, is the spatialization that starts to occur with it. And because it emerged, I think, in the genealogy I tried to show as it came into critical theory, internal colonialism has often been a metaphor for a certain kind of economic disenfranchisement and economic repression within a state. And because it had that delineation and function, the ways in which American Indians were external and brought into the United States falls away.
And you discuss. Go ahead.
Go. I was just going to say, so the emphasis on the internal, in the internal internal colonialism ends up being, again, a way of talking about economic or racial oppression rather than, colonization that happens, in the form of bureaucratic administrative colonialisms in India. It becomes a marker of something different, something that states do to their own people.
Hmm. Yeah. Now, your discussion of the issue of Cherokee Freedmen, and I'm assuming that our listeners have some familiarity with it, so we don't need to sort of reiterate the entire political history in recent years. But at the end of the chapter, you suggest that you want to move beyond some of the common themes that emerge in these discussions, whether it's whether the expulsion is a matter of competition over resources or the congressional response is an attack on indigenous sovereignty, or as some have suggested, a reenactment of removal. What are these refrains missing for you, and where do you hope the conversation goes instead with respect to the Freedmen issue?
Well, the Freedmen issue is something that has to be addressed by Southeastern Indians. And though I, in the book, talk about the Cherokee, certainly the Chickasaw, my own tribe, has our own history that we still have yet to really grapple with in our nation. It's something that it can't be resolved through the standard ways in which we've set these debates up, as you've already sort of laid out, right? The competition, we can't have it be, a bunch of outsiders, freedmen being a bunch of non-native outsiders who are coming in to take things from Indians yet again. These things are much more complicated, in part because slavery itself was a hideously victimized, a hideous institution that destroyed people's connection to family. It destroyed people's privacy and ability to hold on to this, to their own bodies. All of those things, how does one even delineate blood quantum in relationship to that when rape and ownership start to determine how people are related? So one of the things I tried to move us toward at the end of this chapter was an idea of kinship sovereignty. And that was an idea that for me was to look at the ways in which institutions in Southeastern Indian nations have, instead of blood quantum as the necessary identity marker for inclusion into the nation, and certainly the Cherokee Nation was using the Indian blood mark, they sort of reiterated Indian blood is necessary to be Indian. In the case of the Freedmen, they didn't have proof that they had any Cherokee blood. but to instead look at kinship sovereignties, which tie to the responsibilities and relationships that occur through, you know, bringing people into one's family or bringing people into one's lives, requires a kind of reciprocity that Southeastern Indians have not yet fulfilled.
Do you hope that that this work will have some resonance in the broader conversations about that issue?
I do hope that. I do hope, you know, it's such a it is really controversial. It's really difficult to talk about. It's really difficult to parse because, I mean, there are the problems of the ways in which we have approached these topics in the past, where we do center on the competitions of history of certain, allowing certain narratives and historical experiences to take precedent over others. And certainly, you know, in the United States, we have sustained conversations about racism that occur through popular culture at different sites, whether or not those are actually what they should be, certainly is up for debate. But, you know, we don't have the same kind of prevalent discussion about colonialism and its history in the United States on those levels. And so American Indians, we're often forgotten in relationship to this, and it's often assumed that, you know, just by talking about race is already dealing with the history of colonization of American Indians. And so, yeah, I do hope that the framework that I've tried to articulate in this chapter helps to give us new directions that we might have for opening up these conversations in ways that can point us towards solutions instead of sort of spinning through the controversies and the problems and the competitions of, you know, whose story gets to have precedence.
Now, moving off this issue somewhat and broadening a little as we get closer to the end of the discussion, this book and many of the chapters is in conversation with theorists that come from a variety of different fields, from, you know, Judith Butler and Slavoj Žižek and then Deleuze and Guattari, a lot of things that are often difficult for me as a historian to wrap my head around. But I'm wondering if you hope and see a possibility for, just as you take up these theoretical issues raised by you know, people like Žižek or Butler, that you see any possibility or hope that they might in turn read and consider the kind of criticisms that you as an indigenous scholar are bringing to bear and in conversation with them. If you've seen any indication that that's a conversation that might happen between these sort of, you know, rock stars of high theory and people who are, you know, and people who are trying to bring a reckoning with U.S. settler colonialism to bear, whether you see some possibilities for that.
I think especially because of the First Peoples Initiative, because presses like University of Minnesota Press, which has published my book, are really showing huge commitment to publishing Indigenous scholars the last couple of years and into the few years to come. That I think we're starting to see a movement towards a critical mass of conversation, and I think that scholars outside of Indigenous studies are going to have to grapple with the work that we're putting out there, whether, you know, wherever they choose to take it up. It's hard to think about theory stars in that way, just because, you know, I don't know what people read, or, you know, certainly one hopes that the things that you write and put out into the world influence conversations. But I think it's kind of a long game in the end for Indigenous critical theory. It's an emergent conversation. And, you know, I think as more and more people come to it, they hopefully will find that there's potentially something useful there, and answers to the questions that have sort of haunted all of us as we've dealt with the historical violences that created the United States.
Along those lines, I want to return briefly to some questions you pose in the third chapter, and I found them to be incredibly moving and important to bear in mind when reconstructing these histories. You'll indulge me for a moment, I'd like to read again a few of them out loud. You ask, what does it mean to take responsibility for historical present dependent upon middle passages, indentured labor, and the violences of conquest, in which the explicit goal was not just to rupture in the name of enforced labor, but to charter the direct transit from life to death for certain peoples and not others. And a little later, you ask, how might one redress such histories where dislocated arrivals facilitate dislocated removals? How might one imagine radical justice that addresses the cacophonies of colonialism? Obviously, these are big questions, and you don't attempt here to give a definitive answer to them. You do suggest some things.
Sure.
But I'm hoping you can just talk a little bit about what direction we might at least start moving in, you know, not just as scholars, but maybe in the political discourse at large, when we try to wrap our heads around, you know, this idea of radical justice and addressing colonialism.
Mm-hmm. I think, you know, again, it's that long view of history, of understanding that the United States is what it is. Even its economic crises have all emerged and functioned in direct relationship to colonial policies against American Indians. We can see this in, you know, the linkage between U.S. war on terror, the way Osama bin Laden becomes Geronimo. This larger historical trajectory shows, I think, that radical justice depends upon what I can show in the book, which is that indigenous peoples have to be fully functioning and present within the larger political movements that we are imagining as the site of social justice. And
as we near the end of our time together today, I have to just ask, as a major devotee of zombie films, what does zombie imperialism mean to you? And you bring this term up in the conclusion. What do you mean by zombie imperialism?
I had one last thought on the question before, and then I'll talk about zombie imperialism.
I'm sorry,
in part because I'm trying to keep track of all the different pieces moving in my head. It's sometimes a daily endeavor. In the third chapter, I do a close reading and very long reading of a Caribbean author named Wilson Harris, who is one of the first Caribbean writers to really try to address indigenous peoples. And while he maybe doesn't do it in ways that break out of some of the romanticism and primitivism that have been assigned to indigenous peoples, he asks one question for me. There's a moment in his novel Jonestown that for me exemplifies, I think, part of what radical justice might entail. And that's where the narrator, who is the right-hand man to Jim Jones, Jonah Jones in the novel, he finally reconciled himself to his responsibilities to history. And as he's standing on the top of a mountain and he's being judged by the indigenous people there, he initially tries to refuse them. And then he finally says, judge me for being a colonial. Even though he is himself, you know, descendants of slaves, of indigenous peoples, of Europeans, he sees himself as culpable, and he places himself into their hands for their judgment. Mm. And so there, that sense of culpability, of needing to see oneself as accountable to indigenous presences, is part of what I would say is necessary for radical justice within U.S. Empire.
It reminds me of a term you raise in this book that I had never come across, but seems very essential. Is this the difference between settlers and arrivants, which is it's something in the language that I sort of always felt was missing, that I'd never come across it until your book. What is meant by arrivants as opposed to settlers in this discussion?
There's been a lot of push towards articulating settler colonialism. It has always been, within post-colonial theory, sort of a way to talk about Pākehā, white people in Aotearoa, New Zealand, to talk about the folks that come from England as a mother country and do the work of colonialism on the ground. And certainly they are in a precarious position in regards to the fact and what had functioned with regards to the theory, that they see themselves as caught between the power of the mother country and the authenticity of the native. And so you constantly sort of place all the responsibility and focus onto the settler, misses, at least in the United States context, a vastly more complicated relationship. I mean, it's untenable to refer to African Americans as settlers mm-hmm. because of the history of slavery. And yet, African American labor through slavery was, you know, part of the process through which indigenous lands were stripped from Southeastern Indians. It's untenable to refer to people who seek asylum in the United States because of U.S. military imperialism in mm-hmm. Vietnam and around the world, to see them as settlers, even though their presence in the United States impacts indigenous lives.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And so by focusing on arrivant, for me, was a way to problematize and draw attention to the fact that colonialism is not just the work of settlers, but requires a much more nuanced and I don't know, hopefully generous understanding of the forces that have created the problem indigenous peoples in the United States are facing right now.
Hmm. Okay, now I have
so
to
zombie imperialism.
Yes, and I didn't mean to make a flippant transition. It's obviously a serious thing you're addressing at the end, but I of course was taken with the metaphor that you chose. So hoping you can speak about that for a moment.
Yeah, I'll try to do the best I can. You know, in some ways, this is it. Also, sort of, is a place that I'm going to jump off to the next book on. I've always been sort of a fan of genre, especially fantasy, science fiction. I'm a closet video game player, so there's been a huge rise in obsession with zombies, and I was interested. Zombies have, you know, they're very much a new world product that comes exactly out of the history that I chart in the book, right? It's something that comes out of the Caribbean through the African slave trade. It's a critique of colonialism. And it's something that, you know, gets taken up in the 1970s with Romero as a critique of whiteness. And then after 9/11, it starts to turn into sort of a fear of the mindless terrorist other destroying, you know, bastions of civilization. So 28 Days Later, all those types of films start to show the anxieties that get mapped into what was initially a critique of whiteness becomes appropriated by whiteness to critique the hordes of, you know, unwhite, non-white masses who threaten everything that we hold dear, i.e. the United States mm-hmm. and it's about, yeah, just to be clear. And so I was interested in that turn, and I was interested, you know, because I had talked about Zizek and, you know, linking all of this into, you know, broader narratives of, you know, work that Butler has done, Jasbir Puar has done in terrorist assemblages, seeing that, you know, the ways in which even Agamben talks about in his work, the site of the camp, understanding which bodies count as dead, was, you know, again, really, you know, a way for me to open up this notion of grievability, of lamentable, and understand, you know, the biopolitics behind how the United States is bringing together the laws in order to prosecute and torture the peoples it sees as standing in its way.
It's interesting when you speak about the genre and how they and how different symbols in these different genres suggest different things. I was thinking recently about what makes certain villains in horror films or in action films or suspense films so much more frightening than others. And the zombie, similar to a figure like the Joker in The Dark Knight, they're figures that are completely outside of rationality. You can't reason with them. They aren't motivated by the same by greed or by fear or by human emotions that are comprehensible to the hero or the, you know,
right,
the protagonist. And it's interesting to think how that discourse is used similarly in things like the War on Terror.
Well, I sometimes when I teach a course on American Indian genre, I start with something like Mary Rawlinson and her captivity narrative, which is the quintessential zombie attack, with you know, Indians coming out mindlessly slaughtering everything to capture people and captivate them, right, to turn them into themselves. And so that, you know, this even though the zombie as a distinct form existed, the monstrous other has been associated with the Indians all along.
Hmm. Well, I'm very much anticipating that next work, and it sort of preempts a conclusion question I wanted to ask you. But just to remind our listeners, we've been discussing the Transitive Empire, Indigenous Critiques of Colonialism with Dr. Jody Bird at the University of Illinois. We've taken up enough of your time today, Dr. Bird, but I guess by way of conclusion, I was going to ask you if you're working on anything next. I hope we do see a book about what you've just been discussing. I'm also just hoping you can again just tell us what impact you'd like to see from this book, and what audience you envision that impact can be made on with this work you've produced.
All right. So as to the next project, I've already got a working title for it, so it's still, you know, something that's up in the air. It's a project looking at genre video gaming and American Indians, and the title for it is Indigenomicon. Wow. I'm hoping to have at least make some headway on it sometime in the very near future. Mm-hmm. But as for the Transitive Empire, I guess my goal for the book, and you know, I do hope it reaches a broad appeal. I really wanted to try to address the key question of what critical theory, as it has sort of circulated within various traditions from post-structuralism, post-modernism, post-colonialism, what critical theory has left us as a problem with regards to Indigenous peoples. I think it's in the preface I say something on kind of riffing on Robert Williams that says that the American Indian is a problem within law, and I in turn and say, well, the American Indian has been a problem within critical theory. And so, you know, by showing how American Indian studies and the work that we do as scholars sort of can transform questions in Asian American studies, in African American studies, in queer studies, my hope is that I can help people understand that by bringing American Indians into the picture, that these fields usually take up, doesn't mean not directly assessing the very real concerns that those fields have had all along, but that by bringing Indians into it, it makes it much more rich a project to see how things are interconnected and how they are all in support of what is an ongoing colonialism that we are all affected by, no matter how it is that we live in the United States.
Dr. Jody Bird, author of The Transitive Empire, thank you so much for joining New Books in Native American Studies today. I really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you so much. It's been great fun, and I've really enjoyed being able to talk on and on about the book.
I've enjoyed it very much, too. Thank you so much.
You've been listening to an interview with Dr. Jody Bird on her new book, The Transitive Empire, Indigenous Critiques of Colonialism from the University of Minnesota Press. We're on the web at newbooksinnativeamericanstudies.com, where you can listen to all the past podcasts. You can also find us on iTunes, Facebook, and Twitter. If you like our Facebook page, you can post questions, comments, or suggestions for new books you'd like to hear discussed on this program. For the New Books Network, I'm Andrew Epstein, and I hope you join us next month for another new book in Native American Studies. Thanks.